Hey, leader, and welcome to episode number 312 of the L3 Leadership Podcast, where we are obsessed with helping you grow to your maximum potential and to maximize the impact of your leadership. My name is Doug Smith, and I am your host, and today's episode is brought to you by my friends at Bear Tongue Advisors. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. I'm so glad that you're here, and I hope that you'll enjoy our content and become a subscriber. Know that you can also watch all of our conversations over on YouTube as well, so make sure you're subscribed there as well. And if you've been listening to the podcast for a while and we've made an impact on your life, it would mean the world to me if you would leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever app you listen to podcasts through. That really does help us to grow our audience and reach more leaders, so thank you in advance for that. Well, in today's episode, you'll hear my conversation with Mark Miller. I was looking forward to this for a long time and finally got to sit down with Mark. And oh my goodness, is this filled with wisdom. You are going to love, love, love this interview. For those who may be unfamiliar with Mark, let me just tell you a little bit about him. Mark started over 40 years ago working as an hourly employee at a local Chick-fil-A. Since then, he's worked all across the business and currently serves as Vice President of High Performance Leadership. For the last 20 years, Mark has traveled the United States and the world, focusing much of his time on serving leaders by helping them grow themselves, their teams, and their organizations. He's also written 10 books, and his most recent one is called Smart Leadership, where he shares research-based smart choices that the best leaders make to scale their influence and results. And if you've never read a Mark Miller book, I can't encourage you enough to. They are all pure gold. And again, this interview is amazing. You're going to hear Mark talk about the lessons that he's learned in leadership in over 40 years at Chick-fil-A. We'll talk about his new book, Smart Leadership. You'll hear his advice for aspiring authors and so much more. And of course, we end by taking him through the lightning round. You're going to love this episode. But before we get into that, just a few announcements. This episode of the L3 Leadership Podcast is sponsored by Baritung Advisors. The financial advisors at Baritung Advisors help educate and empower clients to make informed financial decisions. You can find out how Baritung Advisors can help you develop a customized financial plan for your financial future by visiting their website at baritungadvisors.com. That's B-E-R-A-T-U-N-G advisors.com. Securities and investment products and services offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA and SIPC, Baritung Advisors, LPL Financial, and L3 Leadership are separate entities. I also want to thank our sponsor, Henny Jewelers. They're a jeweler owned by my friend and mentor, John Henny. And my wife, Laura, and I got our engagement and wedding rings through Henny Jewelers, and we just loved our experience. Not only do they have great jewelry, but they also invest in people. In fact, for every couple that comes in engaged, they give them a book to help them prepare for marriage, and we just love that. So if you're in need of a good jeweler, check out HennyJewelers.com. And with all that being said, let's dive in. Here's my conversation with Mark Miller. Well, hey, Mark Miller, it is an honor to finally get to interview you. I've been following your journey and reading your leadership material for years and years, and I've been wanting to interview you for years and years. So the time has finally come, and I can't wait for not only for me to learn from you, but our audience as well. And I really wanted to, we want to cover a few things today. I want to talk a little bit about your journey at Chick-fil-A and what you've learned along the way. And then I certainly want to spend some time talking about your new book, which I just finished last week, Smart Leadership, phenomenal. So all of your books are phenomenal. If you haven't read a Mark Miller book, you need to. If you're in leadership, it should be required reading everywhere. So we'll talk about that. And then at the end, we can fly through the lightning round as well. But let's start at Chick-fil-A. So you started working at Chick-fil-A 40 years ago, which is crazy. And my understanding is you were the 16th corporate employee. And so can you walk us through the journey of you actually growing and scaling with the company? Because I'm imagining there's not too many people that were around that time that still are today.
Yeah, most of them are dead by now. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So here's the short version of a really, really long story. And it was over 40 years ago. We won't get into all the details, but I started as a team member in one of our local restaurants, and I was awful. I was awful. I've never been particularly good with my hands, and that job really showcased my inadequacies. And it got so bad, I felt like I was going to be fired any day. So I did what made sense to me as a kid. I quit because I thought it would look better on my resume to have quit than to have been fired. And then in a stroke of genius, I decided, hey, maybe I could work at the corporate headquarters, which of course makes no sense and certainly should not be a reflection on any of the professionals at the corporate headquarters, but I couldn't work in the restaurant. And so I went to the home office. I walked in. I told the receptionist that I wanted a job in the warehouse. She told me to have a seat, Just a few minutes later, Truett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A, came out, took me into his office to conduct this interview, which again, sounds crazy. Kind of give him the punchline, you know, why would the CEO be and the founder be interviewing this punk to work in the warehouse? Well, the truth is I was interviewing to be the 16th corporate employee. And when you've only got 15 people, I'm assuming the head guy or the head gal, they're doing the interviewing. And so Truett said, I hear you want to work in the warehouse. And I said, yes, I do. And he said, why do you want to work in the warehouse? And I said, because I don't have any skills. But I assume I could pack boxes. I said, I thought it'd be inappropriate to ask for a job in marketing or human resources, but I can pack boxes. And then he said, who have you been talking to? And I remember thinking, that's a really odd and difficult question. So I said, who have I been talking to about what, sir? He said, who have you been talking to about working in our warehouse? And I said, no one. And he said, well, somebody quit yesterday, so I guess you can have the job. Wow. So my interview consisted of those two questions. I tell people it was a combination of God's grace and Truett's lack of discernment that he gave me that job in the warehouse. And that was actually 43 years ago that he gave me that job. And I've actually had trouble holding down a job ever since. I've worked all over the business over all of those years. And in the early days, I think it had more to do with let the kid do it, let the kid do it. Again, I didn't have any particular skills, but I actually got to start several of the departments and functions at Chick-fil-A. I started our corporate communications group. I started our quality and customer satisfaction group. And over the years, I started several departments and functions before I'd move on to something else.
So would you say, you know, from someone who thought they had no skill sets to obviously over the 40 years, would you say it sounds like your main skill set is really just developing something and handing it off and then focusing on something else? Is that kind of the sweet spot you found yourself in?
No, I think early on it was, again, there were a lot of professional people who had expertise and I didn't have expertise and I would do whatever they wanted me to do. And so I think I fell into that role early, but then later on, again, I've started and sustained a few functions. I was in, I led our training group for about 12 years. So it was kind of an expansion of what the group had done historically, but it was not a startup kind of situation.
And during that training period, is that when you got passionate about leadership development? I mean, clearly you have a passion for developing leaders.
Yes. We found ourselves with what I would call a big opportunity about 20 plus years ago. We realized that our leadership bench was not nearly strong enough. And I don't know if any of your audience would find themselves in that situation, but what we believe to be true is that when an organization has a problem to solve or an opportunity to seize, you generally give it to a leader. And we had problems to solve and opportunities to seize. And we looked over our shoulder and said, uh-oh. And, you know, we hope this person can lead in a few years. We hope this person is going to become a great leader. And so, of course, what you do in those situations is you just double down and give more work to your existing leaders, which is perhaps a short-term answer, but it's a long-term disaster. Wow. And so I was asked to try and figure out how do we accelerate leadership development. And I put together a team of really smart people. And that really started my deep dive in leadership that continues today more than 20 years in the journey. So it was born of need. It was, again, one of those things. OK, I'll work on that if that's what we need. You know, I was leading my team and leading a function, but I was not thinking at that point about the whole organization. In fact, nobody was, which is why we had this issue. See, when we were smaller, our leadership development process was really immersion and osmosis. Mm-hmm. And you can make an argument for that in a really small organization. I mean, that's how I learned a lot about leadership, was sitting around the table with really good leaders. When you've got 16 employees, we had lunch around one table. And I got to sit there with the CEO. I'm just a kid in the warehouse, but I got to sit there at the table with the CEO and the CFO and all the senior leaders. Again, there weren't many of us, and I did learn a lot that way. But by the time we got to the year 2000, we had tens of thousands of people in the organization, when you think about the restaurants as well, who'd never sat around a table like that. And they certainly didn't know Truett Cathy. And so we said, we've got to find a more systematic way to raise up leaders. And again, that's really what started this journey for me.
Yeah. So talk to those leaders. You know, you mentioned, you know, there's leaders, I guarantee you there's leaders listening to this that would say, I'm looking around and I see the exact same thing. I don't have the leaders that I need to do what we're called to do as an organization. You know, what have you found over the period of time that you guys have instilled systems and processes when it comes to identifying and developing leaders?
Yeah. So I'll give you this quick, because I'm going to make this sound easy. You know, I love Q&A, but I hate Q&A because we probably need a half a day to talk about the answer to that. I mean, we've been working on it for 20 years and we're still working on it. So please don't mistake the brevity of my response with the magnitude of that question.
Sure.
But our summary on that is you first have to define it, because what we realized is when we said leadership, everybody nodded. And everybody had their own definition of leadership. And some of them were almost incompatible. It's not that anybody was wrong. At the time, 20 years ago, we found over 6,000 published definitions of leadership. Well, you don't build a leadership culture if everybody has their own working definition. So the first thing we tell organizations is you have to define it. And then you have to teach it. Because for somebody to know, let's just pick something random, that a leader's supposed to cast vision. Well, it's fine for you to know that, but do you know how to do that? Right? There's a skill set. So you got to define it. You got to teach it. You've got to create opportunities for leaders to practice it. In the final analysis, most leaders learn most of what they know about leadership from leading. I mean, it does help you to know the three keys to delegation, or it does help you know, here's the checklist for a good vision, right? It helps to know those things, but you don't really own it and internalize it until you do it. And we have a tendency, we did have, and I think we still fight it, is when we have that problem to solve or that opportunity to seize, if you're not real careful, it's easy to give it to an existing leader. Because they're a known quantity. They've probably got a really good batting average. You probably trust them. And what we're trying to develop the discipline of hitting pause when we have a problem to solve or an opportunity to seize and go, is there an emerging leader that would benefit from this assignment?
So good.
And it can really turbocharge a leader's development. So that third step is to practice it. The fourth step is to measure it. And this is a long conversation, but the gist of it is nothing improves without measurement. And if you want to create a leadership culture, which is what I think these five steps I'm giving you will enable you to do, you actually need to measure your progress. And so the first challenge when somebody hears that is they go, well, that's probably hard. Well, okay, but you're paid for hard. So just get past it might be hard. And a couple things I tell people. One is don't look for a single metric, because we spend a lot of time trying to figure out, is there a single metric to quantify and assess our leadership culture? We couldn't figure it out. So it's probably a family of metrics, and it may be a dynamic set of metrics that it changes with the needs of the business. Let me give you one example, because I don't know how far you want to go down this rabbit hole. But if you're just starting to build a leadership culture, one of the metrics, as crazy as this sounds, is what percentage of our leaders have been trained on our leadership point of view. And you need to get that to 100%. Guess what? After you do, you don't really need that metric, because I'm going to assume that you're going to build a system that trains new leaders. But in that ramp up stage, that's probably an important metric on your scorecard. Now, 5 years, 10 years, somewhere down into the future, you may want a metric that says, how many leaders do we have currently on the bench who are ready for their next opportunity? See, we evaluate emerging leaders on ready now, ready in 1 to 2 years, ready in 3 to 5 years, because you're trying to take these people on a developmental journey. And so one potential metric is, how many ready now leaders do you have in the wing? So I'm using that only to illustrate there are infinite number of metrics that you could use, but we think if you want to stay on course, validate the efficacy of this process, you're going to need to measure it. I mean, what's important in your life and business that you don't really measure?
Yeah.
Right. You're not going to quit looking at your bank statement. You're not going to stop looking at your P&L if you're in business. Well, you see, you got to measure it. It's important. Customer satisfaction, you know, whatever, turnover, retention. Well, you look at those things because it's important and you want to steward it well. So, and then the final is that you have to model it. If the existing leaders don't model the behaviors that you're advocating, you're just dead in the water. Hmm. You'll never create a leadership culture because that erodes trust and credibility, not just in your leadership point of view, but in your leaders. So you got to define it. You got to teach it. You got to practice it. You got to measure it and you got to model it. And that'll help you create a leadership culture. Now, if you want a deep dive on that, I wrote a book on that called Leaders Made Here. And let me say a word about books because books may come up a couple of times here.
Yeah.
In this talk, I've given away all the profits that I've received for the last 20 years. And that is my plan going forward. So it gives me a little more freedom to say, hey, this book might help you. It's not a side hustle. Chick-fil-A pays my salary, and I'm very thankful for that. And so we're able to create resources that'll serve the world. And then if we sell resources, we get to serve the world by giving that money away.
Amazing. I'm just out of curiosity, what are some of your causes that you give to? What are you passionate about?
Goodness gracious, this might shock you. I give it to several global leadership organizations.
Wow.
I think everything rises and falls on leadership. And so my wife and I do that. We support a large AIDS relief organization in East Africa. We support a longstanding organization in China that works with orphans and widows. And so we've just got several tentacles out there where we give those funds.
Yeah. Mark, one thing that you mentioned that I'm curious about, you talked about emerging leaders, and it sounded like you have a system. I think you said ready now, ready 1 to 3 years, 3 to 5 years. How do you quantify that, or how do you define, you know, a emerging leader's readiness? I'm just curious what those categories are and what are the characteristics of them?
Well, so let me again put a disclaimer on this because we're having a short conversation about a huge topic. We have changed this several times over the last 20 years because we're always trying to make it better. But to your specific question, it is a qualitative assessment primarily, but we want it to be behaviorally grounded. So we do leadership reviews every year of existing current leaders in place. And so we do this at the leadership team level. And so a leadership team will sit and talk about their leaders. And so somebody will say, I think Pam is a 4 on a 5-point scale. And then we start asking questions. Well, okay, why do you think she's a 4? Why is she not a 5? And then we'll say, you know, we've got a point of view on leadership. Give us an example of how she sees the future. Give us an example of how she engages and develops others. Give us an example of how she reinvents continuously. And this can go either way. Based on their answers, we go, man, you're grading too hard. She sounds like a 5. Or we may say, we don't think she's a 4 because you gave us a blank stare on 3 of those. So we're gonna collectively as a group lower her rating. And so it's subjective, behaviorally based.
So good. Anything else there?
There's a lot more there.
Yeah, we could go there. On. So good. So you saw Chick-fil-A, you know, go from, I mean, I can't imagine where it was 43 years ago when you started to where it is today. I'm just curious, were there 2 or 3 pivotal moments in the organization's history that you would say that moment was an absolute game changer? That moment, any of those you want to share with us?
Yes and no. So I'll give you a pivotal moment that was really important as a factor in our success, but not while we're successful. So the moment was in 1982. The business was really struggling. Interest rates were really high. Sales were soft. We were under some financial stress and strain. We just built a new headquarters building, and our executive committee went off to try and create the plan, right? The recovery plan. How are we going to get things back on track? I mean, some you're too young to remember this. Interest rates were over 20%.
That's crazy.
I mean, it was a crazy time in America. And so the executive committee went off to figure out what's the plan. And at that meeting, somebody asked the seemingly simple question, why are we doing all this? Which led to a very lengthy discussion. And out of that came our corporate purpose. And so they came back after this 2 or 3 day retreat with a single statement that I think was one of those defining moments. They said, look, we're not sure what the future holds, but we needed to be really clear on why we're doing what we're doing. And what they came back with is our corporate purpose is to glorify God by being a faithful steward of all that's entrusted to us and to have a positive influence on everyone who comes in contact with Chick-fil-A. And they said, we'll have to figure the rest of it out. So it was the forerunner to Simon Sinek's Start With Why. These guys in 1982 said, we need to get real clarity on why we're doing this. And so that was a defining moment. But here's why I think we've been successful. And many in your audience will be familiar with Jim Collins. He's a friend of ours, has spoken at our events on several occasions. And we've had our senior leaders visit with him out in Boulder. Just a great guy. And he talks about the flywheel. The reason that we've been successful, it's every single push by every team member and every operator in every restaurant every day. You combine that with every push by every corporate staff member every day. And this thing has just gained momentum and it's just gained speed. And I think it would be it'd be wrong to say it was this push or that push. Now, I think the corporate purpose was a big push, but there have been millions of pushes. Our team members are going to serve millions of guests today, millions of customers today, and they're going to do it with honor, dignity, and respect, and every one of those pushes that flywheel. And so I think that's why we're successful is we're pushing the flywheel every single day.
This fun question just came to my mind as you share that. I don't know why. 43 years of Chick-fil-A. If you had to make an estimate of how many Chick-fil-A sandwiches you've consumed in 43 years, what would you throw that number at?
Yeah. Oh, man, give me a calculator. I've eaten a lot of them because one of my responsibilities during that season, I already mentioned that we started the quality department, and we were the first ones to establish our quality requirements for the restaurants. And so we tasted a lot of chicken sandwiches doing that. And then I was also a director in field operations, working with business consultants and operators. And we just said, every time we're in a restaurant, we're going to eat food, even if we're not going there to eat food. Because we think it's the right thing to do. We're in the restaurant business, right? And so pretty much every Chick-fil-A restaurant I've been in almost for 43 years, I eat food.
That's beautiful. You got to spend time with True Kathy, employee number, 16. I'm just curious, legendary leader. There's a lot of legendary leaders in your organization. What are the top 2 or 3 things you learned from his life and business career?
Wow. I think generosity. Not many. Some people may know this about Truett, but I mean, he didn't give for show. In fact, nobody knows how much money he's given away in his lifetime. But he, I believe, is the most generous person I've ever met. Wow. And that rubs off on you. And I think I'm more generous today because I had somebody I really loved and respected who modeled that for me. And in countless ways, not just with his money, but with his time and his attention, his interest. In the early years, I worked with Truett more than I did in the latter years. But even into his 90s, when he and I would interact, he would ask about my family. And he'd ask about them by name. Wow. And at that point, we had thousands of employees, right? It's like, just very generous, very generous. So that'd be the first thing. I think the other thing is we talk about the fact that the best leaders value results and relationships, and that creates in many situations some tension. Again, going back to Jim Collins, he talks about the genius of the and. If you can find things that appear to be in conflict and embrace them both, there's real power. There's energy even in the friction. And Truett is the best leader I've ever known at valuing results and relationships. He's going to ask me about my family, and he expected me to do really good work.
Wow.
I mean, he had there were just many, many examples over the years where he valued results and relationships. A lot of leaders fall into this trap, and they defer to their natural bias, because most leaders have a natural bias. They're either more results-oriented or more relationship-oriented. And Truett may have had a bias, but he valued both. And that's what we encourage our leaders to do. Independent of your bias, the best leaders value results and relationships. And Truett was a master at that.
That's beautiful. I want to dive into your book, Smart Leadership. So you've written many, many books, as you mentioned. Why did you write this, and what do you want leaders to get out of it?
Wow. Okay. People have often asked me, I'm gonna give you a question that you didn't ask that people often ask getting into this.
Yeah.
People say, what do all these books have in common? Because, by the way, this one is different. If anybody has read any of my previous books, they've all been fables. This is a traditional leadership book. I've got a new publisher. They wanted a traditional book, and I said, I'll try, right? We'll just call it an experiment. But all the books have one thing in common. They're all based on need. We do our very best to identify current or near-term need, because you have to start a book project oftentimes several years in advance. So it's a little bit about where do we think the puck is going? And I have to be honest, sometimes it's where do we think the puck should go as we try to practice a little thought leadership here. But this book came, as many, many of the others, out of this realization that more and more leaders appeared to be struggling mightily. And this was pre-pandemic. And we said, what could we do to serve leaders who are struggling? So there's an important distinction. We don't need to camp out here, but somebody said, well, this book teach me to lead. I said, nope, this book's for leaders.
Yeah.
They said, really? I said, yeah, I got a bunch of books that'll teach you to lead. This is for a leader who's struggling. Think about a pitcher, a major league pitcher, who's having trouble hitting the strike zone. They don't need to learn to pitch. They got to tweak something, adjust something, get their mind right. They got to find the strike zone again. Their value's already been established. Their role's already been established. They're not trying to decide, am I going to be a catcher or an outfielder? They're a pitcher. Somebody's already paying them. But they're not performing at their highest level. And so we saw all these leaders struggling. Really, a lot of leaders. Maybe I'm just hanging out with the wrong leaders, but I saw a bunch of leaders struggling. And so we started on this, and then the pandemic came. And you could say 100 times as many leaders were struggling. But we think that what we saw before the pandemic was just exacerbated by it. Leaders are struggling with what we call quicksand. Busyness, distractions, complexity. I mean, make your own list. In fact, I shared that list with some leaders early on. And they said, well, yeah, I hear all that, but mine's different. I said, okay, what's holding you back? And they said, fear, fatigue, aimlessness. So my point is, make a long list. Anything that's keeping you from reaching your full potential as a leader, anything that's impeding your impact, we're going to put it into this one big toxic mix, and we're going to call it quicksand. And so we said, okay, the research team came together and said, we're going to figure out, like, what's causing all this quicksand? Well, we quickly discovered that there are leaders that have this seeming knack for staying out of quicksand. And if they get in it, they get out really quick. And so we said, hey, let's go study them. Because we thought quicksand was the problem. And then what we ultimately decided is the leaders who stay in the quicksand are their own problem. Because you can get out. I mean, you think about it, the way we framed it, you really only have three choices when you get in quicksand. One is you can just give up. You can just quit. And I think that's a big part of this great resignation we're hearing about. Yeah. A lot of people just saying, this is too hard and I'm quitting. Now, those that don't resign, they may actually die. Now, even if they don't physically die, their hopes and their dreams are extinguished in the quicksand because it's just so hard. Hmm. Well, the second group, which I think is the majority of leaders that I know, they are trying to learn to swim in the quicksand. Now, you actually can do that, but there are two fundamental problems. One, you're never going to win a gold medal swimming in quicksand, right? You can't lead at your highest level, and it's exhausting. And if you do it too long, you're probably going to end up in that other category of a leader that just quits. So the only viable option is option three, at least from my perspective. We said we've got to figure out how to help leaders get out of the quicksand. And so that's actually what the book is about, helping leaders get to that solid, dry ground where they can do what they know how to do.
Yeah. And you lay out four choices in the book of how to get out, which I love. There's a few things I want to focus on that I loved in the book. You did focus a lot on talking about the importance of investing in yourself through coaches and consultants. And you've talked about how you've done that personally and how life-changing that's been to you. Why should leaders pay for coaching? Why should leaders get consultants in their life and business to help them get out quicker?
Okay, so this, thank you. That's a great question. This goes to that first choice,
yeah,
which is to confront reality. And the truth is, it's hard to confront reality. It's sometimes hard to discern reality because we're too close to it, right? And we're in quicksand. And so fresh eyes is the concept as we talk about it in the book. And there are a lot of ways you can do that, including coaches, consultants, peer groups. I'm in a group that's been meeting for 23 years now, twice a month, talking about leadership every other Monday night for 3 hours. And we're doing that Monday night again. And so any number of ways, I don't know if I mentioned mentors, coaches, consultants, mentors, peer groups, there's a lot of ways you can do this. But these are men and women who can see things that you can't see and are willing to tell you. They may or may not have the answers, but think about great athletes, great musicians, men and women at the top of their game. They have coaches. Coaches can see things you can't see. It's hard for an NBA player to see their form when they're shooting a free throw. But a coach can see that and say, hey, that elbow's starting to move up a little bit. That's why you're pulling to the left. Oh, thanks, coach. Boom, here we go. So they can add value that it's just really hard to do for yourself.
Yeah. Along those lines, you mentioned mentors, and you know, I'm so grateful for mentors I had early on in my journey. They would bring in leaders from the community to share leadership with us. And they'd say, hey, you know, if you heard Mark today and you connected with him, you should ask him out to coffee, ask him to mentor you. And you actually lay out this process in your book. When I was reading, I'm like, yes, every leader needs to read this because this is how you connect with people. And you shared a story about talking. There's a section on talking to strangers. And I believe his name's Dr. DeBono. Can you just talk about what is your approach? And again, you have a bigger platform now, but throughout your career, what has been your approach to pursuing mentorship and even conversations with leaders that you maybe didn't think you can get a conversation with?
Yeah. So I think for me, those may be two slightly different things. So let me take them one at a time. For a mentor, I think a lot of people that don't have a mentor, they've set their sights too high. And they want the best in the world at something. That's the first problem. They've also set their sights too high because they want somebody to help them with their fitness, their faith, their finances, their family, their career, and their education and their study methods. It's like, no, no. So you've aimed too high and you've aimed too broad. So what I tell folks to do is find somebody that's a little bit further ahead than you are. That's the, and they're willing to help you in a specific area. which is why you may need several mentors in your life at any given time. And I think that's fine. Again, the man or woman that can do all of that, I don't even know if they exist. So I encourage people, don't aim too high and focus what you want to learn and the area in which you want to grow. Now, the last part of that is I do know people I know and love, thought leaders, who say a mentoring relationship is a lifetime relationship. Yeah, I don't set the bar that high either. I'll ask somebody if I can buy their lunch or I can buy their dinner. And if there's some chemistry there and if there's some connection there, I'd say, hey, would it be okay if we had another meeting? And it can literally go just like that. Now, you may have long-term relationships with these folks. I had one mentor for 20 years till he passed away. And that's great. But I've had many, many other mentors that might be a meeting or two meetings or six meetings. Because see, at some point, you're going to learn what you need from that mentor. And you're probably going to need another mentor. Same is true of a paid coach. I've had paid coaches that I might work with for a while. And at some point, they start recycling their content. And it's like, okay, I need a new coach. I need to go to another level. I think this guy is giving me all he's got, and that's fine. And it was mutually beneficial. So I don't aim too high. I don't think too broadly, and I don't think long term on the mentoring side. On the conversations with strangers, I just think you got to be bold and be prepared for them to say no, and it's okay. And one of the things I've done over the years, just as a learning methodology, is to go to conferences. And I am all about approaching a speaker after they speak and say, can I buy your lunch? Can I buy your dinner? You referenced Dr. Edward DeBono that I talk about in the book. For those that don't know him, at the time he had written 76 books on creativity. He is the world's thought leader on the topic of creativity. I'd read several of his books. I'd taught some of his content. He spoke at this event and I said, hey, can I buy your breakfast, lunch, or dinner while you're in town? And he said, let's go eat right now.
Fantastic. Awesome.
And we had about two and a half hour conversation over lunch, and it cost me a sandwich.
Wow. A Chick-fil-A sandwich?
If I hadn't asked him, the answer would have been no.
Yeah. Was it a Chick-fil-A sandwich?
It was not.
Okay. Hey, just thought I'd see.
That would have made better, but it was not.
Yeah. One of the quicksand traps that you said leaders are finding themselves in is they're too busy and they don't have any margin in their life. And you have a whole section on margin. Can you talk about margin in your life? And you have library trips, I believe. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that process has meant to you?
Yeah. So you might make the case that this was one of the insights from a couple of years of research. I mean, I like to think there were several, but we didn't walk into this thinking that one of the keys to leadership effectiveness is margin. And it was screaming in the literature and the interviews. It was just screaming at us. It's like, No, this is a huge, huge deal. And so as I began to socialize that, I literally had leaders look at me like I was crazy, and a couple of them told me I was crazy. And that makes sense. I mean, I am crazy. But if you're in quicksand and somebody says you need margin in your life, they're going to think you're a fool. And one person articulated it like this, and they said, I don't have time for a vacation. Well, that flip the light bulb on in my head. Okay, I've not communicated well. I said, I don't know if you need a vacation or not, and you may need one. I said, I'm not talking about margin as a vacation. I'm talking about margin as a leadership discipline. And he said, well, what does that mean? I said, okay, when do you purposefully have time to reflect, to assess, to think, to create, and to plan? And he looked at me like, well, I said, I think I've got my answer. But how do you lead at the highest level if you don't have time to reflect, to assess, to think, to create, and to plan? Because who do you think's doing that? Your team's probably not doing that, because if you're in quicksand, you probably drug them in there too. somebody's got to get out. And so people say, well, how much time do I need? So, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I will say this, the bigger your dreams, the more responsibility you have, the bigger your challenges, the bigger your problems, the more time you need in margin. Talked to one guy when he got promoted to be the president of his company. He doubled the amount of margin in his life. Wow. He said, I felt like I had no choice. So people think it's extracurricular when it is actually core. It's core. And so it's something that it makes a lot of sense. If you've done it, if you've not done it, it sounds insane. And so I encourage leaders, find 2 hours next week. I say, well, how do you know I need 2 hours? I don't know that you need 2 hours. You may need 2 days. You may need 20 minutes. Find 2 hours next week. Put it on your calendar as a meeting with me. So when somebody else wants that time, you look at your calendar and go, oh, no, I'm sorry. I've got a meeting. And in that time, pick a topic, pick a challenge, pick a problem. Reflect, assess, think, create, and plan on how you can better address that opportunity, that issue, or that problem. And I believe you'll find that it becomes your most valuable time every week as a leader will be time that you spend alone. And this goes back throughout history, thousands of years. They're case study after case study after case study. If you start looking into the lives of great leaders, I haven't found one yet that didn't have margin as a personal discipline.
Well, leaders, I'm loving this interview. I'm sure you are too. And again, the book is Smart Leadership. If you don't have a copy of this, get it. And really, if you've never read Mark's books or taken your leadership team through Mark's books, can't encourage it enough. I want to move into just some fun questions, lightning round questions before we wrap up. And I'm curious, speaking of books, you've written multiple books. Anytime I meet an author who's had success like you have, I would just ask, what advice do you have for aspiring authors?
Well, it's really simple, and I've given it to hundreds of aspiring authors, and I'm not sure any of them have appreciated it. So I'm just going to warn you, you got to get a first draft. And it's going to be awful. So don't worry about it being awful. The first draft's always awful. But until you get a first draft, you don't have anything. Maybe you call it a dream. I tell authors, get a first draft. I'll be writing and telling myself, this is awful, and I keep writing. So one fun story about that. Yeah. When I did my first book 20 years ago, I gave the first draft to my wife and said, take a look. And so first thing she said is, this is not half as bad as I thought it would be. She's got the gift of encouragement. And then the second thing she said is, shouldn't you have used some punctuation? And I said, that will be the second draft. And I gave her a red marker and I said, you put in all the punctuation and we'll add it. I don't even put punctuation in a first draft. Wow. I mean, not much, because I'm trying to get stuff on the paper. And I, like you, I have talked to scores and scores of authors over the last 30 years. And I always ask them, and the good ones all say that to me. They say, you got to get a first draft. You got to get a first draft. It's going to be bad. If you hold your standards too high, you may never finish that thing. Trying to get it right and trying to get it perfected is get a first draft.
So I want to move into the lightning round. A bunch of fun questions that I ask in every interview. And the first is, what's the best advice you've received and who gave it to you, ever received?
Okay. Have I got time for a short story real quick?
Go for it.
Short story about that. Some people in your audience will have done a tweet chat. I didn't know what a tweet chat was. And so they were explaining it to me. This is for a prior book. They said, it's like talking to the whole world at one time on Twitter. And I went, well, that sounds fun. And so for those that don't know how it works is there's a host and they put out a question and I answer it. And for 5 minutes, the Twittersphere responds to my answer and everybody else's questions. And then you get your second question, 5 minutes, third question, and this goes for an hour.
Wow.
and things were going by so fast on the screen. It was making my head explode. And we got to the last question and somebody said, what's the best leadership advice you ever received? So I was telling my mom this. At the time, she was close to 80, and she knew this much about Twitter. And she said, at least you had 125 words to respond. And I said, no, Mom, that would be characters, not words. And she said, well, that was probably pretty hard. And I said, yeah, it was. And here's what I tweeted that day in the midst of my tweet chat. Best leadership advice I ever received. Above all else, guard your heart. For everything you do flows from it.
Wow.
And somebody said, that sounds really good. And I said, well, the wisest man ever lived said that. Solomon said that in Proverbs. But I think that's the best leadership advice I've ever received. Because most leaders don't fail for lack of skills. It's leadership character that trips up most leaders. So you got to guard your heart.
If you could put a quote on a billboard for everyone to read, what would it say?
Great leaders serve.
What's the best purchase you've made in the last year for $100 or less?
2 weeks ago, I bought a $10 plastic sled that I went sledding with my grandkids.
Oh, man, that must have been awesome.
It was really good.
I love seeing grandpas. I have three kids, and watching my dad sled. He's 73. Watching him sled ride, there's nothing greater. So, other than your own, you know, do you have one or two books that dramatically impacted your life that you'd recommend all leaders read?
Yes, The Effective Executive by Peter Drucker. In fact, I referenced that in the introduction of Smart Leadership. And I said, if you've not read Drucker's book, you should put mine down and go read his. It's kind of the source of the Nile for leadership material, even though he wrote it 50 years ago. So that's always my first recommendation. A newer book that is not particularly targeted to leaders that I really love is Brendan Burchard's book, High Performance Habits. And it certainly applies to leaders, but it also applies to humans, and I love that book. That's a really good, a lot of practical ideas, principle-based, a lot of research behind it. So I'm a fan of high-performance habits.
What's your greatest leadership pet peeve?
Effort.
Say more about that.
We don't control – there's so many times in our lives we actually don't control the outcomes. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Sometimes it goes right, sometimes it goes wrong. Sometimes something you're experimenting with works. Sometimes your prototype fails. So we don't always control those things, but we always control our effort. And I just want people to be 100%. For me, that's a stewardship issue.
Yeah. You could spend time with a lot of high quality leaders. I'm just curious, do you have a go-to question or two that you always ask when you get a meeting with a leader? You want to learn from? Yeah.
Well, I've been collecting questions a long time. And in fact, there's a chapter in the book called Ask, Don't Tell. And so I'm a huge fan of questions. I like to think that I'm going to customize my list of questions when I'm going to be with a particular leader. But if by random chance and surprise, I'm with a leader, one of the things I'm going to ask them is what were the books that were most influential in their formation as a leader? I mean, some people like to say, what are you reading now? And I think that's interesting. But if somebody's been reading books for 20 or 30 years, I'm not as concerned about what they're reading now, but which books had the greatest influence and impact on them. So that's probably a pretty safe, if I've got time for just a few questions, that is going to be one of them.
Yeah, last two questions. If you could go back to if you could have coffee with yourself at any age that you think would have made a significant impact, if you could sit down with yourself and tell yourself something at that age, what age would it be and what would you tell that Mark?
This is a good question, but I'm going to tell you something that I was told when I was young that made all the difference.
Let's go.
And I was probably 19. And it's your capacity to grow determines your capacity to lead. Because that was a candidate to put on the billboard, right? And here's why that's relevant to me. I can't speak to your audience. I was sharing this story with someone one day, that statement, and they said, well, that's probably easy for you. And I said, well, tell me what you mean by that and why. And I don't know if members of your audience are familiar with Strength Finders, where you take this test and this assessment, and it tells you all the things you're good at. Well, one of the 34 is learner. And so this person said, I bet you're a learner, and it's surely in your top five. So this is easy for you, right? Your capacity to grow determines your capacity to lead. I said, no, I don't think learner's in my top 30. They said, that's odd. They said, you act like a learner. I said, well, thanks. I made a choice.
Wow.
Over 40 years ago, when somebody explained to me, if you want more influence, if you want more opportunity, if you want more impact, you have to choose lifelong learning. And I remember thinking, so that's how the world works. Because my parents wish I'd have decided that much earlier. I was a lousy student, right? I mean, I just was. But when I said, I want influence, I want opportunity, I want impact, I want responsibility. So I said, I'm going to be a lifelong learner. Now, I'd much rather listen to the radio in the car than a podcast or a book. But I made a choice because the way the world works, I believed it then. I believe it more now. Your capacity to grow determines your capacity to lead. So anytime I get a chance to talk to young leaders, I want them to hear that. And last thought on that, somebody even asked me this point blank. They said, so you're telling me if I'm a learner, I'm going to be promoted. I said, absolutely not. We control our readiness. Wow. Our organizations control our opportunity. It's back to that effort thing. Now, if you're in an organization and you can't get opportunity, you've got another choice to make. Do I need to go to a different organization to get opportunity?
Yeah.
But it's like the kid on the bench. If the coach doesn't think he or she is ready, they're not going to put him in the game. So that's a message I try to share with young people every chance I get, and old people, because I don't think it's ever too late to say, I'm going to commit to lifelong learning. And as soon as you do, you're on the path to greater influence and greater impact.
Yeah, and last question would just be, on the other end of your life, you know, what do you want your legacy to be? What do you want Mark Miller to be remembered for? And then after you answer that, you can just close out with any advice that you want to leave leaders with today.
Well, I actually hope that when I get to the end of my journey, that those that knew me well will say that I was a good steward, that I was a steward of the opportunity, I was a steward of the influence, I was a steward of the resources, I was a steward of the ideas. Yeah, I think that's a great privilege that we have to use the things that have been entrusted to us. And so that's what I'm trying to do.
Anything
as far
else
as a final word.
Yeah.
Do what?
Yep. That's what I was going to say. Final word.
Final word. I would encourage everybody listening to try and figure out how you can make a difference in your world, because every leader can. Now, sometimes leaders, myself included, may become a bit discouraged because we have these grandiose plans and visions, and I think that's great, and I think we should, but sometimes we can lose sight of the changes we can make in our world in real time, today and tomorrow. Every leader has the capacity to change their world. You got to get out of the quicksand to do it. But the choices that we've talked about a couple of them today, they are your superpower.
Yeah.
and you can literally change the world.
Well, Mark, thank you for changing the world the way you have at Chick-fil-A and to leaders all over the world. Thank you for investing in me and Jesse in this conversation and everyone that will listen to this, and just keep making your mark. It's a significant one, and it's been an honor to have a conversation with you today.
Glad to be with you.
Well, hey, leader, thank you so much for listening to my conversation with Mark. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find ways to connect with him and links to everything that we discussed in the show notes at l3leadership.org/312. And leader, I always want to challenge you that if you want to 10x your growth this year, that you need to either launch or join an L3 Leadership Mastermind Group. Mastermind groups have been the greatest source of growth in my life over the last 7 years. If you're unfamiliar with what they are, they're just simply groups of 6 to 12 leaders that meet together on a consistent basis for at least 1 year in order to help each other grow, hold each other accountable, go after their goals together, and to do life together. So if you're interested in learning more about masterminds, go to l3leadership.org/masterminds. And as always, I like to end every episode with a quote, and I'll quote Mark Miller today. I actually just Googled Mark Miller quote, and this came up, and I thought it was so good. He said, "If you don't demonstrate leadership character, your skills and your results will be discounted, if not dismissed." So powerful, leaders. We say it all the time here. Character development is the most important development. Well, I hope, again, you enjoyed this episode and you were encouraged by it. Know that Laura and I love you. We believe in you. And leader, we say it all the time, but do not quit. Keep leading. The world needs your leadership. We'll talk to you next episode.